Thanks, Susan, for that. And I also want to start by thanking Megan for driving down from D.C. to join us for this event. I also want to thank everyone who's in the room and the University of Virginia Law School more generally for supporting the work that we've done that happily has formed part of this contemporary story about the lifting of the combat exclusion policy. It's been a really exciting couple of years and certainly an exciting month. My own way into this issue, though, began a long time ago. My area of expertise includes feminist jurisprudence. And in the area of feminist legal thought, the connection between theory and practice is exceptionally important. I take it that the connection between theory and practice is important for many, many lawyers and many legal scholars. So legal scholars practicing lawyers are always thinking about the connection, the dialogue, and so forth between theory on the one hand and practice on the other. But for feminists, it's been something that they have thought about for at least 100 years, probably longer. And like other lawyers and legal scholars who are invested in bringing about some kind of social change, you really want to be able to identify the theories that are going to move the practice or the practice that generates the theories. It's not a one-way street. So this has been something that I've been thinking about for a very long time. It's not that the Molly Pitchers are an escapade, quite the opposite, but for me it started as an experiment that felt kind of like an escapade, the thought that I would actually step outside of the classroom, outside of the confines of theory and teaching, and to begin inching out into the world of practice, was one that took some doing and a lot of support from a lot of people. But just to be clear, when I speak of feminist jurisprudence or feminist legal theory, some of you will have studied these topics, and you'll know that the area is very complex, it's very rich. It's not fair to say there is a feminist theory extant. There are many. The area is complex. But I think that it is fair to say that what motivated the entire feminist legal theory project was the insight from John Stuart Mill that males and females are equal, right? We are equal in terms of judging our capabilities, our talents, our aspirations, our promise, our opportunities, our obligations. We're equal. And that means that the law, at a minimum, should treat us as if we're equal. There should be no discrimination between males and females. So when I speak of feminist jurisprudence, I just want to reassure you that I'm speaking about a very traditional liberal idea about equality between males and females. And so I just want to read to you, nobody said it better than John Stuart Mill did back in the 1800s. He says at the beginning of his important essay, "The legal subordination of one sex to the other is wrong in itself, and now is one of the chief hindrances to human improvement. Here's his practical suggestion. It ought to be replaced by a principle of perfect equality, admitting no power or privilege on the one side, nor disability on the other." So his theory is the principle of perfect equality. The law and other important institutions should just treat males and females as if they are equal, admit no power or privilege on the one side, nor disability on the other. So that insight, as you probably know, motivated a great deal of legal reform in the country. So at the time Mill is writing, of course, women don't have the suffrage. When women married, they lost their legal selves. Their legal selves were completely subsumed in that of their husbands. They no longer could contract. They couldn't own property. They couldn't run up debts. We even couldn't commit our own crimes. If we committed crimes, it was presumed that it was our husband's crime, and which looks kind of handy if you don't want to go to jail. but it's deeply disrespectful, completely ignoring the woman's agency and independence, and so forth. So, lot has changed in the world. since Mill wrote. But one of the things that was fascinating to me when I joined the Legal Academy was that there were a couple of places, very important places, where this basic insight, principle of perfect equality, was being violated. And nobody seemed to care. There were people that cared, and there were a couple of women. We have a couple of wonderful service women in the audience. I've got to give them a shout out, and I take it that they noticed and perhaps cared, but continued to do their work. So Ruth Bader Ginsburg is understood to be and correctly credited with being the architect of the equal protection revolution on behalf of women. So in the 1970s, the story goes, she picks up Mill's argument, and you can see his argument shaping her briefs. And at that time, it was quite common to see the law containing formal sex-based classifications. There were things that men were allowed to do that women couldn't, places where women were not allowed to be, places where men were not allowed to be, and so forth. So it was very common to see formal discrimination. And that, of course, was Ruth Bader Ginsburg's task. One of the reasons she brings her cases is because she can't get a job, right? She graduates from law school, law review, you know, top of her class, and yet has a very, very difficult time getting a job. That's the environment she's in. So she figures, well, I'll start the Women's Rights Project, litigate these cases, and change the world. And she did change the world, so much so that when I entered the Legal Academy, again, it was taken as a given that formal discrimination was dead. And so when I would speak to students, they believed that they lived in a world where at least formally the principle of perfect equality had taken hold. Right? So if you were born female, you were born male, didn't matter. You could be whoever you wanted to be, you know, assuming that you invested your personal capital wisely and satisfied the criteria. So over the years in my feminist theory courses, feminist jurisprudence courses, and ultimately in law and public service, I would point out that there was still this very dramatic example of formal discrimination against women, and I argue against men, embedded in the combat exclusion policies that under which the military excluded women, barred women from prohibiting in ground combat, and also in the selective service system, which requires men to register for the draft but not women. And this was just something that really, really bothered me. And so I've been talking about it, what, for at least 20 years now. Mary Wood, our wonderful publications person, keeps sending me copies of speeches that I gave like a dozen years ago saying someday a lawsuit will topple the, you know, these forms of discrimination. So over the years I would lecture and I would talk and I would say, why does no one bring this lawsuit? This is a lawsuit waiting to happen. And from the perspective of a law professor, con law professor, it just clearly is. It's such a blatant form of discrimination. So what happened along the way was a group of students in my law and public service class pointed out to me that perhaps the reason the lawsuit wasn't being brought was because no one wanted to bring it, right? So law professors can have theories about the way in which the law should be reformed. They should have theories of justice. They should be committed to a principle of perfect equality. But maybe the people in the world on whose behalf they're making those arguments aren't interested or don't feel the injury that the professor perceives. Okay, so from my perspective, this was deeply injurious, really disrespectful of women. It denied women access to full participation in that core requirement, obligation, and opportunity of citizenship to participate in the national defense. I thought this was deeply disrespectful, but that's just me. So my students, Rebecca Cohen, who's not here, Aria Linnett, who is here, Kyle Malinek, who is here, and Helen O'Baron-Hardiman said, you know, maybe no one agrees with you. Maybe the reason the ACLU, Women's Rights Project, hasn't brought this lawsuit is because the women in the services don't feel injured or they have good reason for not suing. So that conversation and a number of others, them basically saying, and other students in the class saying, you know, not do something or shut up, but just, you know, maybe it's time to do something. Let's go out into the world and begin to investigate. So it was at that point that, for me, that theory and practice began to merge. So we, the students and I, agreed, oh, we couldn't litigate this case. The law school wouldn't fund this case. How could I take on the case? I am a full-time law professor. I don't know how to litigate, and so on and so forth. But gradually, step by step, we left the academy and reached out to many of you. Some of you are in the room. We had conversations with lots of law students who had been vets, whose family members were in the military. Our networks grew and our networks expanded. And we discovered pretty quickly that there were women in the world who were suffering legal injury from this policy and who perceived themselves to be injured by it. We had numerous phone calls, emails, conference calls, and so forth, in which women would describe in great detail the way in which this policy had an adverse effect on their career options. And it's no small thing to join an institution and to be told at the very beginning that your path is limited, sharply limited, because of your sex. Merely because you're a female, you can't do certain jobs. You might be physically fit for that job. You might be psychologically fit, intellectually fit. You might be better than everybody else that's competing, but merely because you're a female, you can't do that job. So a couple things happened. One, we heard these stories, and some of them were really anguished. Others were, God bless you. I can't believe someone's finally noticing. And then there were a lot of people who said, we're with you, but we can't step up and be the face for this campaign because we're really worried about the effects on our jobs. You know, these are working people. These are jobs. So enter Megan. So I had come around to agreeing with Rebecca and Ariel and Kyle and Helen that maybe we should continue to research the framework for the litigation. I even spoke to our deans about it. We looked to continue the discussions to be sure that we thought we had a good substantive case and develop lists of experts and so forth. But the minute we found live plaintiffs, it was at that point that theory and practice just, you know, smashed together, and we knew we had to have real lawyers, that theorists were no longer going to cut it, right? And I thought long and hard about this question. Kyle and I made a trip to, we went to Augusta, right? Kyle and I made a trip to Augusta to visit with a potential plaintiff, and I don't know if Kyle said, you're crossing the Rubicon when I got on the plane, but it really felt that way. It's like, oh my gosh, I have left the ivory tower. I am flying in the air to meet someone who might actually think that she should hire us to be her litigators. And this woman said to me, one of the most perceptive things that's been said by any of the people that I've met in terms of her assessment of us as lawyers and the project, she said, I'm really afraid to do this. I'm just absolutely terrified to do this, but I have a daughter. She had a 2-year-old daughter named Lucy, and I feel like I have to do this for my daughter and my granddaughter. She said, but I need to know more about you and your legal team. And so the metaphor she used was, if I'm going to do this, I want to be sure that I'm not playing a pickup game of basketball in some back alley somewhere. I want to be sure that we're going for the gold, that we have an Olympic team. And it was just, I was like, okay, I got it, right? So among the meetings that we had, we thought long and hard, who could we recruit? And we were to help us. Could we find actual practicing lawyers who could take this theory and try to implement it and operationalize it in the world? We were able to identify one of our great alums of the law school, a lawyer named Tally Parham, who herself had been a fighter pilot, and she gave us cover for a while. She's at a small firm in South Carolina, and so that took a lot of the pressure off, the concern that we were violating ethics rules and terrifying the dean and so forth. But the most important moment for me or one of maybe five very important moments for me, finding our plaintiffs was huge, was the day I spoke to Chris Sipes, a partner at Covington & Burling. We had decided that Covington was at the top of our list of firms that we would just, our dream team would be Covington. I called Chris Sipes, and 5 minutes into the conversation, I thought I was making a pitch about how I was going to have to write a long memo to persuade the pro bono committee to take the case. He said, "Nope, I'll take the case. Great, that's a great case. You take the case. I'll assemble my team." And so I'm going, "You'll assemble your team? You know, can I have that in writing?" And so that's it. That's the story. I mean, theory and practice came together at that moment. But then, to be honest, the theory people had to step aside, and that's been difficult for us. So to the extent that we're actually talking honestly about what this experience was like, it was our project. We were the Molly Pitchers. We spent a ton of time identifying the framework for the case, seeking plaintiffs, gradually getting some national attention, and boom, just when it was time to do the work, we realized we couldn't do it ourselves. We weren't competent to do it, and I'm glad we had the humility to recognize that. It's an important, very important issue. So Covington stepped up, and it's not like they tried to muscle us out of the way, but it was simply that our job was done in the sense that we didn't know how to write a complaint. So I was really thrilled when I said to Chris, "Should the pitchers start drafting a complaint?" And he said, "Oh no, Ann." I was like, "Whew." And then at other points he'd say, "Ann, we're filing a lawsuit. We're not writing a dissertation." You know, because I'd always want to say, "Well, one more. Let me do one more." No. We're filing a lawsuit. This is not a dissertation. And then, of course, because they were the lawyers and we were not, there were privilege issues, right? So we were suddenly pushed to the side. We had to be in order to protect the case going forward. I'm going to turn it over to Megan in a minute so she can talk from her side about how she sees this relationship between theory and practice. But I want to say a couple of other things. First, I want to be quite humble about our assessment of the litigation's effect on the Secretary's recent decision to lift the combat exclusion policy. In a delightful conversation with Chris Sipes, he and I both high-fived over the phone and said, "Yep, the Secretary of Defense read our papers, Secretary of Defense read our opposition to the motion to dismiss, and he thought, I can't litigate against those people." And clearly that's not the story, right? We wish it was. But the time was ripe because women and men in the services have been working together in combat theaters. The women have been clearly showing that they're able to satisfy the necessary standards. We've reached a sort of tipping point, if you will, in the empirical realities, the political realities, and the changing culture. And it's just now the time was ripe. On the other hand, we have been part of the story, and I think for good cause, because litigation, when it's brought at the right time, with the right kind of law firm, with the right kind of resources, and of course the ACLU brought its companion case to ours. When they noticed our project, they called and said, "Oh, what are you doing?" And I didn't dare tell them, "I have no idea." Instead, told them what we were doing. Litigation, we think, probably played some role in the timing, because you have to come to court and you have to satisfy deadlines. Our case was pending. You know, the judge was on the verge of saying we have to have oral argument. And again, there was, in our view, it was going to be impossible for the Secretary of Defense and the other defendants to come in and defend this case with a straight face given the work that they've been doing. So we think that the litigation probably played some role in the timing. Minor, hard to say what. But more important, what litigation does, and it's here that theory and practice, I think, come together, is that in cases like this one, it really does provide a vehicle for the injuries that people have been suffering, a place for them to express their injuries in a concrete way. And we can capture those injuries as lawyers and take them to a court and say, tell us why this is just in the year 2012 and the year 2013 to continue violating this theory of perfect equality. So to all of you as law students, I mean, this is just the most awesome experience that I have ever had in my life. And it was for law students and classes and years of law students. So, you know, I name individual law students and they get the credit. I would never have done this. But they said to me, you have to. You have to stop theorizing and you have to start doing. And so I'm intensely grateful to them, to the University of Virginia Law School for supporting the project. But I also want to make the pitch to all of you. I was just astonished at the difference they made and how they really have made us part of this historical moment in this story. Now it's your turn.
So good evening, everyone. I just wanted to start again by thanking the Journal of Social Policy and the Law for inviting me here today, and Professor Coughlin, and also all of you that worked on the Molly Pitcher Project. I really just want to echo what Professor Coughlin said. I mean, I don't think we could have gotten to the point where we had this case and we were ready to go forward with litigation without all of the work that happened behind it. You know, it's a really sort of interesting intersection where a lot of the theory was sort of developed and brought to us, and then we at that point can sort of take our expertise, our familiarity with litigation, and go from there. And I just want to mention, I am representative of the Covington team tonight. I am by no means the only person on the team. Chris Sipes, as Professor Coughlin mentioned, and then also we have another 3 to 4 attorneys working on the case as well. It's a great group of people. So really, once we sort of picked up this issue and picked up the case, our work was really to develop the legal theories and to fit them into the actual framework of litigation. One of the core sort of values at Covington is that every attorney that works there, even though we're a general practice firm, should devote some of their time to pro bono work. And, you know, the pro bono that we focus on are pro bono cases that have local sort of impacts, but then also affect generally a broader spectrum of the population, affect civil rights. And so, you know, this is one of those cases that clearly fit right into those goals. Being at a law firm, we really have sort of the expertise at that point in time where we can really use what we know, which is how to litigate. We know the courts, we know how to file a complaint, how to respond to a motion to dismiss. You know, we know the different judges, we know the forums, we know how to litigate against all different types of defendants. So that's really where we sort of added in our perspective to this case. A lot of these cases, particularly from our perspective, are really driven by the individual people on the team. So, it's sort of what the individual attorneys feel is right and feel like they're the cases they want to pursue, and those are the cases that we sort of work for and go with. I think everyone has sort of different reasons and different sort of rationales for why they take on certain cases or they want to be involved with different cases. And I think it's, you can see it in the group of people that we have working together. Everyone has a little bit of a different perspective, a different reason for why they're on the case. And that's really helpful because when you're litigating, when we're drafting the complaint, responding to the motion to dismiss, it's important that we see sort of everyone's perspectives. So, you need those people who can look at things from a different angle and say, well, but what is, what's defense counsel going to do? What are they going to argue? What's the judge going to say when they see this? And so it's really important to sort of have those different perspectives and fit them all in. You know, for me, I think this case has really, it's been a great experience for me. It's very different from what I do on a day-to-day basis. I'm a litigator, but it sort of, you know, challenges me to think about different issues and different topics. And so I've really enjoyed my time on the case. It's sort of strikes home with me too. I was really excited to be involved with this because I have a close friend who joined the Army right out of college, and I remember her struggling with this and trying to figure out exactly what she wanted to do and what she could do because there were some challenges there for her. So I just want to sort of give you a sense of what actually on the ground we have been doing with the project. You know, there are many, many different aspects that you need to consider and that all sort of have gone into this litigation as it's developed. And Professor Coughlin and the Molly Pitcher Project, I mean, was really involved with one of those first tasks, which was actually finding the right plaintiffs and finding the people who were going to bring this case forward and really be the people that stand up and challenge the policy. You know, there's a lot of things to consider, sort of trying to figure out who those plaintiffs should be. There's a lot of things that go into that. It's really what the plaintiffs, what their stories are, what they're comfortable with. I think as Professor Coughlin said, not everyone is in a position where they feel like they can actually stand up and challenge the policies and be a named plaintiff on the lawsuit and have their names out there. It's also important, I mean, from a practical perspective, to think about who the plaintiffs actually can be. I mean, who has an injury, who legally will satisfy all of the requirements for standing to actually allow the case to go forward. So who has an injury that can be redressed. Those are important aspects that need to be considered. And a lot of research goes into that and figuring out exactly who the right people are and who will fit into the case in the long term. And, you know, one of the things I think that's sort of happened with this case is as it's progressed from the theory and the Molly Pitcher Project to the lawsuit that's actually been filed is that it's really the named plaintiffs at this point in time, Colonel Herring and Command Sergeant Major Baldwin are really, those are the center, they're our clients, they are the plaintiffs. I mean, the case from here on out is, you know, what is best for them. They're the plaintiffs. And so it's really sort of transformed now into this place where it's all about the plaintiffs and you know what is best for them. So I mean, some of the other sort of issues that we've had that we've worked through and had to identify. I mean, you have to come up with the right legal theory. So we all know the theory sort of behind equality and whether or not you know the sort of broad legal theory, but you need an actual cause of action, right? So we needed to figure out what challenges we can bring and exactly how to do that in the form of a complaint, what needs to be alleged in that complaint. Another important aspect to that is the defendants. I mean, that's not necessarily just an easy task to say, we'll just sue the U.S. government. You have to go through and figure out who the right people are. Identify the right individuals, make sure we have all of our bases covered so that the government can't just respond and say, well, no, actually, you didn't sue the right person, so dismiss the complaint. So that takes some work as well. There are the procedural aspects to the case that you wouldn't necessarily think about coming from sort of the theory side of it, but where are we going to sue? I mean, which court is best for us? Which is most favorable? Where do we even have jurisdiction? Can we even serve the complaint? You have to affect service. We have to make sure it gets there. If we can't do all of those things, then the case isn't going to go forward. It's just like any other type of litigation. It's, you know, all those boxes need to be checked, and those are all the things that, you know, we as litigators who you know, litigate other things on a daily basis or are familiar with and sort of go through the checklist. And then, you know, after, as the case progresses, same process as with other civil litigation. You have to figure out discovery, written requests, all of that, the same as we would otherwise. And so I think that these types of cases, particularly from my perspective as, you know, the practitioner, I'm an attorney, I litigate, I'm not really in the academic world as much, but these types of cases really, you know, add to what I can do on a daily basis. They really sort of push me to think about other things, to think about other issues outside of what my sort of general practice might be. And what struck me the most is really getting to know the people that I've been working with on the case, particularly the plaintiffs, getting to know their stories. They're just both really impressive women. And, you know, just to be able to sort of engage with them and push their cause forward has been really a great experience for me. And I think the same stands for everyone else, all my other colleagues that have been working on the case as well. And so, you know, we have filed the complaint. Professor Coughlin sort of alluded to this earlier. The government did file a motion to dismiss, and so we've gone through briefing. And at this point in time, it's before the judge. We don't have a decision or anything. And now, recently, Secretary Panetta has made his announcement. So it remains to be seen exactly how that will affect the litigation in the future, but that's where we are right now.